Setting up shop.
Hi everyone, welcome back to Setting Up Shop, your favorite maker journey podcast about selling the things that you make. I'm not sure if there are any others, but so ours must be your favorite because you are back here again. My name's Dan, I'm a wood turner from the UK, and with me as always are Rasmus Lohen, a blacksmith from Norway, and Heidi Jacobs, a potter from America. I was going to be more specific in America there for a moment, Heidi, and I thought I'm going to get it wrong if I try and do that.
Oh yeah,
where do you think even I'm though from? I know where you're it like, actually is, I was having a brain moment where I was
you're like Ohio, and I'm like, no.
It's going to be like Pennsylvania. Oh, no, wait a minute, no, it began with P. I was close. So yeah, I hope everyone is doing well. Couple of little things before we get started. First of all, some of you have badgered us a little bit about merch. We are doing that. We are working on a shop. We have actually actively started doing that. Others of you haven't said anything to me because I've been really, really bad about putting our social media up. So you won't have seen anything to interact with. I am actively trying to get back into the rhythm of doing that. However, January was January. So we're going to move past that point now. And unlike the Norwegians, the sunshine is coming back to us more rapidly.
Oh, yeah.
So we actually are more likely to be active. So what are we going to talk about today? Or is Dan just going to keep waffling? What we're going to talk about is when to retire. That's the subject title, when to retire. And that's not actually, as in you yourself, when do you stop working? More of a case of when do you retire products or an idea or a concept or equipment? Or, you know, when is it a good time to take a thing and stop doing that thing? And that retirement may or may not be permanent. So that's our overarching concept today and signs that we can look at when to retire things. Same as I did, I think, last episode. I'm going to jump on Rasmus for this one first. And if we look at maybe early ideas that you were forging with, Rasmus, is there anything there that you pursued for a little while and then you decided, do you know what? I think we're going to retire this one and just, you know, it's not selling or it's not going or whatever. And you may even still have some stock of it lying around in a corner somewhere.
You are basically calling out all of the things. most of the things I made early on feels like I have retired. It depends a bit on how you view it, I guess. But I feel like at the moment, the only things I made, like in my first couple of years that I still make is Essooks, Hardtooks, and the occasional knife blade.
So the blacksmith golden trilogy of
kind of
not selling. Yeah. So what were some of the things you did make that you've retired?
I mean, there was a lot of things that were just poorly made because I weren't all that good at the time. Okay. And then I also haven't revisited them. But I did like the stereotypical thing of like taking old wrenches and forging out into cutlery. I was like, it was fun, but it wasn't good. It wasn't well made. It looked kind of cool. I sold a couple. I might have sold, maybe two sets out of maybe eight that I made or something. So I was like, okay. Yeah, eventually they all just went to a scrap pile in between all of the dozen moves I've done, it feels like.
And all the local mechanics breathed a sigh of relief because their 13-inch banners stopped going missing.
Yeah. It's a good size for cutlery, actually.
Okay, fair enough. That's interesting because you've also answered the question of why you've retired them as well in the sense of it's not, it wasn't necessarily that it was a product that wasn't selling as such. It was more of a case of you were developing your skill set. So you'd recognized you'd moved on from that stage. Mm. Okay, cool. What about yourself, Heidi?
You know, probably this similar thing for Rasmus. There's like, when you start out in any craft, there's, you know, just throwing, what's that old adage of throwing spaghetti at the wall, see what sticks, see if it sticks. And for a while, I had a really diverse portfolio of things that I was trying to be really good at. And then as I started to narrow my niche, I started to eliminate some things. So like plates, platters, those kind of things. I still do them from time to time, like you were saying, like they're not fully retired. They just come forth, you know, at certain times of year where it makes sense, or like after a few years where, you know, it's like, oh, I'm seeing this trending back up, so I'm going to start making them again. I wouldn't say that anything in my portfolio is like completely, absolutely dead retired. Maybe covered butter dishes.
Is that something that's been retired before you started making it?
Yeah, it didn't even make it to fruition. I may revisit that after I built a box for Ben that I'm getting ready to fire. So if that goes successful, okay, then I might see where I'm at with hand building again. But it, you know, there's just those things. I think to me, there's things that you do out of necessity for learning your craft.
Mm-hmm.
And those things can, you know, ebb and flow. But then there are things that you realize maybe thematically no longer are really that great, like maybe political items that you were doing for a period of time and the theme kind of fell off. And then there are things like some people really lean into making things seasonally, right? And I was just thinking about this the other day, like how gung-ho I was the first 2 years of my business to do specific seasonal work. So I'm talking about things for Valentine's Day, things for Mother's Day, things for Father's Day, very specific things that maybe don't carry over throughout the rest of the year. Being a small business owner and being able to maintain an inventory of those things, It's a position where like that whole process to me might be something that I've retired in a way, just like me doing events and selling things at events. So not necessarily a product specifically, but maybe more a thematic thing or a business approach that I've retired for the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a very valuable thing to talk about. It could even, like you say, it could just be a process you've retired that you know, you used to do something in a certain way. Your reason for retiring that could be, as we've mentioned in the past, you know, posture was wrong when doing that. So it's been bad for your health. It's given you, you know, muscular problems or whatever else. So you've even though it might have been the most efficient way of making the thing at the time, it was bad on you. So you've retired that process and gone to something that would take longer, but is better for your health or something like that. Yeah, it's definitely worth assessing stuff like where are you in your maker journey that you're, like you say, you started off with thematic stuff. Oh, okay, you know, you're going to pick the popular holidays throughout the calendar and you're going to make things specifically for that, which is an understandable thing of people going, oh, but people buy loads of that kind of stuff at this point in time. Yeah, they do, but that's like a 3-week window for that one thing. And then you've got stock that's now out of date.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it also bleeds across, doesn't it, into trends and how, like, I don't know about you guys, but so traditionally in wood turning at Christmas, you will see a lot of hand-turned Christmas trees and snowmen every year that people will give as gifts or try and sell at craft markets and stuff. And there'll be various sizes and maybe they'll be painted, maybe they won't and whatever. But for the last couple of years, something that certainly has become really popular at Christmas is turning donks or like gnome things with like massive beards and like a big cap. So they're a European, I think, are they more of a Scandi type thing, Raz?
The way I recall them, yeah.
So they're basically a squat figure with the face is basically beard. You might have two wooden feet poking out, a wooden nose, and then it's got a big hat on the top. So it's a relatively simple shape to make, but you can make them so they look quite cute. And it's something a bit different from a Christmas tree or a snowman. And so they seem to have, you know, the last, as I say, 2 years. But I definitely noticed this year that they were already on the downturn. Like they were a real blip of a trend of something to make. And I'm sure, you know, there'll be a few around for a couple of years, but it will drop off again.
It's like the bandsaw reindeer.
Yeah, exactly like the bandsaw reindeer. Yeah. So for those who aren't aware, again, it's exactly as it sounds. It's a shape that you can make out of a block of wood on a reindeer. It's a single piece of wood. You glue a pattern or tape a pattern onto it and you make a series of cuts. And then, hey, presto, you've got a reindeer. And it's, depending on how well you do it, it can look quite good. But really, you can only give them away to your family for 1 year or try and sell them for 1 year before the following year. It's like, unless you're going to do the whole thing and you're going to know, no, this one's Dasher. And then the next year it's Donna. And then, you know, you're actually building the whole set as you go along. It's a little bit awkward. So yeah, seasonal as well as trend stuff. I can't wait for river tables to have gone, just completely disappeared, to have moved way over there. Yeah. It's not as popular, but there's one of my colleagues at work is still making 2 or 3 a month.
Whoa.
People. Yeah. So that's the thing. I think river tables have passed out aside of the maker community. But yeah. It's still such a unique and pretty looking thing that the normal people outside of the maker community still want to buy it.
Yeah, it's not makers who want them anymore. It's weekend warriors will come into the shop and be like, I want to do such and such. And then you explain to them that the amount of resin in that table is going to cost you £800 before you've bought the wood or thought about legs or the machinery to process it or the sanding and the whatever. Or I can give you the number of a sadist over there who likes making them and he'll do it for you. You'll pay more money, but it will be finished.
Gosh, anytime anybody says anything about resin, and I just think bubbles and discoloration, and I'm like, nope.
Yeah, no. Exactly that. I mean, don't get me wrong. It as a product, if you can find a thing where it fits in well to what you're doing, it can accentuate things. It can rescue some pieces of wood or other products that otherwise wouldn't be able to be used. I totally accept that. I'm just done with them now. I cringe every time someone comes in and starts inquiring about doing it, and I'm just like, this is where the bad salesperson kicks in. I'm like, do you really want to go through this hassle?
That's
like,
where Dan becomes a wood snob.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And I've never said otherwise. I've always now,
do you have a thing against end grain butcher block style
chopping boards? I don't have a thing against end grain style chopping boards, because if they are done properly, they take quite a lot of effort and skill to actually do properly.
Yeah, the maths on those are hard.
I do have an issue with people telling me they've made an end grain chopping board, and what they've done is they've gone to a hardware store and bought a kitchen countertop that's already glued together, and then they've cut a rectangle out of it. And sanded the edges and said, I've made a butcher block chopping board. It's like, no, you haven't, because you haven't even inverted it so it's end grain. So, you know, like, fair play if you buy that as a starting point, because it's machine flat and pressure glued so it's right, and then you can cut your strips out of them and then stack them up and glue them. Fine with that. Reusing the resources.
Cheat code.
Yeah, exactly. Because who's got a 600 mil wide sander or a thicknesser or whatever? But yeah, there's a lot of snobbery. That's a subject title all on its own. That's a separate episode, is snobbery. I'm going to write that down.
Please write that down. Rasmus, put it in the Notion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I what can be more than the champion on that one, I'm sure. But I'm sure other people, you guys have put your own ones. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Ply steel. Yeah.
Yeah.
When to retire the term Damascus? All of the trendy buzzwords. But on the flip side to that, though, as much as we hate it, if that's what the customer is trying to buy at the moment, is that something, if it's not that far out of what you're already doing, is that the sort of thing that you lean into? And do you lean into a trend rather than leaning away from it? And saying, well, no, that's not part of my craft, which is a form of snobbery to a certain extent.
I think so. But also, I think those trends can start to foment some excitement for some of your crafts, where, like, maybe historically everybody is just like, all woodcraft is just about joinery and miters.
Yeah.
And they miss the exciting bits. And every once in a while, you see those movements of trends coming back around because more people are, you know, weekend warriors trying something out and they're learning something. We see the same things in, I'm sure, in blacksmithing, but in pottery, it's, you know, kintsugi. Oh, well, I broke a mug. Can I kintsugi that? Yeah. Or, you know, people doing colored slip and creating that marbled pattern around their pieces. Like, there are so many, like, trendy things that get people excited about your craft. But I agree with you.
Anything.
Like,
there's, I mean, anything made with railroad spikes.
Oh, for sure. Oh, people welding them together to make little figurines.
I think we've delved further into the snobbery subject already, haven't we?
But yeah, we have. Help us get out.
This might have to be a two-part episode on snobbery, I think, or a three-part. Each of us could pick our own subject and just go off on one. We've written in comments. I'm sure there'll be some of it there. So when to retire a subject that you're talking about in the middle of an episode? It's not
how do you retire
an episode? Let's exit the building from that. You brought up an interesting element of this as well, Rasmus, before we got started, which is when to retire customers.
Yeah.
And I know it was a flippant passing comment, but I think it also got some value to it in the sense of when do you take the emotion out of the decision as a business owner of maybe you've got an awkward customer who's trying to ask a load of questions for a commission, and you've been going back and forth with email ping pong for like months, and they keep moving the boundaries and they keep changing their mind and they keep shifting the budget, and the only person who's losing out in this is you, really, because you're potentially putting a lot of effort in. But when do you make that choice?
I think I've done it on three different occasions, actually. And it all kind of depends. Like, one is just how easy is it actually to talk and deal with the customer? Like mm-hmm. you said, if they keep moving the goalpost, if they keep changing the terms or the design or anything, and especially if it's something I'm not excited about making in the beginning, like if it's just plain welding and they keep being difficult or uncommittal in their decisions, like they are flaky and they go like, maybe powder coated, maybe raw steel look, maybe forged look. And I was like, yeah, okay, fuck off for a minute, decide, and then maybe come back to me about it. But then also other times I've had, like, I've completed a job for a customer and kind of the job itself went fine, but getting the money or the full payment afterwards was a hassle. Mm. And then they come back to me and they want more work done. I was like, no, sorry, I am too busy at the moment.
Yeah.
Try again next year, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, it can definitely have tricky things, can't it? I've almost got the reverse at the moment, where I had a potentially large commission from a interior design guy who contacted me before Christmas, and I said, my books are full until January, but I'll be, and he said, yeah, that's great. And communicated a few more times, sent some plans. I said, okay, I'll get them drawn up professionally, because it was just a Photoshop picture, or not even a Photoshop picture, it was more like Microsoft Paint picture. Anyway, I got them professionally done and I sent him a copy of them and said, hey, look, we're near the end of January, I'm ready to get going on these. And then he's just ghosted me, which is fine. Like, I'm not outlaid a huge amount of money, and I might still make one of the forms myself. I've got the plans, I've got the digital and the printouts, so I can play around with it myself. But it's you then got that conversation of, well, if the guy comes back to me and ignores that project and comes up with something completely new, do you then retire that customer and say, well, actually, the first project I made for you, there was an issue, but not until after I delivered. The second project that we approached, there's been an issue. So how many times do you have the conversation before you do retire them? And like you say, I think you've got to balance it individually on how much work is it going to be to get you to a point where you can have a conversation with them, and what's that going to cost you before you know they're going to commit or not. And that's something that can only come from experience, can't it? All three of us have kind of probably been through those things, and someone presents you with an opportunity and you're like, oh wow, that's really cool, yeah, I want to do that, yeah, that would be great, and you stop thinking analytically and it's all emotional brain and that kind of stuff, and then you're halfway through making the first thing, having put other stuff on hold, and then they cancel on it or something like that.
Yeah, I have that happen as well. Sort of, I have jumped the gun, basically, because I was about to get things ordered from the laser cutter anyway. They came to me with a fairly distinct plan, measurements and everything. And I was like, cool, I'll just toss it in with the same order. I'll give them a price right away. And if they go for it, I'll be halfway there already. And then they didn't. And then I still have the parts ready laying around. And it's like, well, I can still use those parts for other things. I haven't yet. But the time investment here isn't all that much. And I saw the possibility of just making this a whole lot easier for myself, but gambling on the fact that they thought the price was fair.
Yeah.
I don't recall if they thought that was a bit too much or if they want to go in a different direction. But either way, that just fell through.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the key term. You gambled. You said, I feel fairly confident that this is going to move forward. This is going to be the best cost. I'm going to be able to find it. I'm going to go ahead and pull the trigger. Like, is that really their fault at the end? Like, is that a reason to retire them as a client? Probably not, but it definitely adds to the list of problematic clients.
It's time to retire that part of attitude, though, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah.
If we shift it on a little bit, it's part of the growth thing of sometimes taking that leap of faith is like, you need to be shoved and take it and really go for it to move things forwards. And then other times you can find you're almost too much momentum and you're falling. And so you just naturally keep falling. And you will just go, oh yeah, it'll be fine because I've done this already and that was fine, so this will be fine. And then three, it will be fines that haven't worked out later. You suddenly realize, oh no, this is actually, I'm falling out of a plane without a parachute, and this is probably not the best plan, and I really need some people to come and help me. So I think it's good to recognize signs when you do need to retire certain ways of thinking or certain ways of working as well that can be detrimental to what you're doing. Because otherwise you end up with a pile of half-made things in the corner that may or may not be able to be other things.
And hey, stop calling out.
I'm talking about myself.
Oh.
See how relatable it is? I'm thinking about one of the larger clients that I worked with is like a really good like badge of honor. Like, yeah, you know, I'm working with this client. It's a really well-known company doing wholesale for them. However, it's pay-to-play. So essentially, I had to expand my insurance to cover their requirements for liability. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I was paying more in insurance than I was in returns. So they weren't ordering enough product for that liability to warrant me spending that much money on my insurance. It's not that they were a bad client. It's not that, you know, I didn't enjoy making the products. It's not that I didn't get some kind of commercial benefit from it. It's just that at the end of the day, the pay-to-play model just really wasn't worth it to me. And I think you also have to, you can look at that in terms of how much does it cost for a booth fee? How much does it cost for me to have a shelf in your store? It just goes back to that pay to play. I have to pay a certain amount to this person in order to even have my product in their space.
Yeah.
That's a huge realization. I think when you're early on in your business, you're just so hungry that you're like, I can ignore this if I can just get in the door. Yeah. And then as you start to establish yourself and you get into these other situations where maybe you're treated better, or maybe there's more foot traffic in this space, or maybe the orders are actually evening out where you're actually making a profit from that partnership, you know, those evaluations about whether or not you stay with that client or stay with that service, I think are really big, especially as you've established yourself. Like, I don't know if we talked about this previously. We may have, where there's that certain allotted investment period where you can kind of determine that your business is not going to make a dollar the first several years, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's all about reinvesting back into the business or getting loans to be able to invest in the business to get stock or material, or stock and material, same thing, machinery or whatever.
Yeah.
And then there's a certain point where you evaluate, like, was that worth it? You know, should I repeat that in 5 years? Should I continue repeating those same efforts? Did they warrant the monetary investment? Did they warrant the time investment? And I think when you look at clients, you know, that's a big space where I wear my heart on my sleeve and I want everybody to like me. And that's a problem for a business owner, because Laura Kampf has a tagline that's always favors, never orders. That's building relationships. That's, you know, building a community. It's very hard to build a business that way. As much as you want to be like, I want everybody to feel like we're raising everybody up at the same time. Like, if I benefit, you benefit, and we all benefit. But unfortunately, in business, that's not always the case. Like, sometimes people will benefit more from what you're offering. Sometimes you'll benefit more. But also there's that like detachment that you almost need to do to survive as a business owner. And it's a place where I struggle the most, I think.
Yeah.
That relationship of being able to say, you know what, this isn't lucrative, or being able to go back in and say like, hey, I need to raise my prices.
Yeah.
I don't know if that aligns with what you are thinking this year, but, you know, I can't continue this moving forward. And sometimes it's not about, you know, you breaking up with them. Sometimes it's a mutual breakup.
Yeah. I think all of that is really valuable things to think about, because, you know, I can remember one of the first sort of maker business people I spoke to specifically having a conversation with me. They'd asked me to potentially make some stuff and like bring it in and show examples, and I did. And then they asked about costs, and I'd kind of figured my costs out, and I said what, you know, I thought I wanted to charge, and they didn't bat an eyelid, and they took their phone out and they started doing some calculations, and I sort of jumped the gun and I was like, oh, if I need to go lower, like, let me know, kind of thing. And they stopped and looked at me and they were just like, this is a business transaction. Take any emotion out of it whatsoever. Like, this is a free lesson.
Yeah.
Like, don't say that ever. Like, stick to your guns on it. It's up to me as the person potentially buying from you to figure out, is it worth me doing it? Mm. And if it's not, then it's not. And you know, you've not made anything yet. We've had a conversation. You made a sample. Either way, I'm buying the sample off you. So you're not losing out, but just don't, you know, just hold off, stick to your guns. And so that was something I've retired that attitude very quickly, of that kind of desperate, needy kind of,
yeah.
please just buy my things. I need the validation that I'm good at making things.
I also don't think that's like a like, I don't want to ostracize people that are starting out and saying like, no, it's awful for you to like have that hunger. But it is like a, we call it like phases in project management. Like, you're getting through phase one. So phase one is developing your business and understanding your identity in your business. Phase two is, you know, really seeing what works and identifying if it's something that continue to work. Phase three is like really getting on a roll and starting to reinvest in your business. Right. So I like kind of that humanization of looking back at yourself and going like, God damn it, you motherfucker. Like, why would you do that? But I think it's also important to like understand like where that comes from. It comes from a place of maybe feeling insecure about, like you were saying, like, I just want somebody to like what I'm doing and give me that praise.
Give me the validation.
Yeah. But I also like, I don't want to make anybody feel bad if that's the place that they're in right now. But I also want to tell my like early potter self like to not be so ashamed of that that energy, because it really is what helps you to build a foundation in a way.
I think one of the things that we all know that the majority of creative people struggle with is pricing their work and actually pricing it at what it's worth.
Right.
And I've been very fortunate in that over various years and times and stuff, I've been able to, through working in retail and not in retail and working in businesses and all this kind of stuff, that I've learned some very invaluable lessons, and I'm still learning them. And that's part of the reason why we're sharing stuff on this podcast. So one of my most recent commissions was for a furniture maker. He came into the shop and he was like, oh, do you know any wood turners? Mine's just retired and I need someone to make some cabinet draw pull knobs. And I was like, yeah, sure, I can do that for you. Delivered those a couple of weeks ago. He was absolutely happy. But before I delivered them, I went and took him a sample and I showed him the sample of the two sizes that he had specified, which was great because he recognized straight away that the larger one that he wanted was not going to work for the project. So that's a big lesson for anyone. If you're getting into something, if someone's asking you to make a batch of a huge amount of things, or, you know, more than five that are the same, and they've asked for two sizes and they're not sure, make a sample of each one and take it to them and go, hey, here you go. This is for free if possible. And it really helps. And they appreciate it.
It's for free if you already got a deposit for a larger order.
It depends, because I haven't finished the story yet.
Okay. Sorry.
So naturally he then got to the point of asking about price. Okay. Mm. Now, bearing in mind, these things were just under an inch in diameter and just under an inch and a quarter long.
Mm.
So they are not big. So that's 24 mil diameter and it was 30 mil long. Okay. They still took me 10 minutes to turn each one.
Mm.
All right. And you know, I'm happy to chat about this on air, as it were. I ended up charging £5 a piece for those. He supplied the timber.
Okay.
And it was pre-cut into sections. So I literally, all I had to do was power on the lathe, sharpen my tools and sand them. I didn't have to apply any finish.
Hmm.
So minimal consumable costs and my time. And that was realistically it, you know, and sort of power charge and that kind of thing. But I charged that rate because that built in the cost of the sample.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm happy with that.
But on the flip side, as you say, Raz, if they've basically said we're gonna buy no matter what, and you go, right, okay, half the amount up front, then fair enough, you've got to build that into the price. But we're not talking about pricing again. But it's having the confidence to have that conversation. Because I was unsure at that point of what to charge. In my head, I knew that I needed to charge £5 a unit. That's what I knew I needed to do to be properly in profit. But I felt guilty because of the size of the item. But yep. With having the conversation with the guy who was making the piece of furniture, I said, oh, well, I'm unsure at the moment because of, you know, this is my normal hourly workshop rate. And they're currently taking me about this amount of time. So it wouldn't take him long to figure out where I was headed. And I said, but, you know, I appreciate that, you know, they're quite small. And he just stopped me there and he said, look, Dan, this is for a piece of furniture that's going to end up in London. This is a one-off bespoke piece. You need to charge what you need to charge for your work. Now, I'm, again, very fortunate because that's another creative person who didn't just go, well, if you're only going to charge £3, fantastic, I'll just profit the extra.
Yeah.
He's someone who's been doing this a long time. He doesn't need to create the extra profit if he doesn't want to. And he's kind of almost passing the torch of some of the advice. So being able to think ahead before you have that kind of conversation and plan everything out and work out exactly what you want to charge and exactly what you think you should have, so that you can in effect retire that attitude of, oh, well, I'm not sure, what do you think, which is the worst thing in a business perspective you can say to someone who is trying to buy a service from you. Trying to retire that is quite valuable, actually, because it helps you come across certainly as much more professional, a little bit less potentially needy or potentially kind of unsure of yourself, even if that's true. You know, practice it or role play it with a friend or partner and kind of have the fake conversation about it if you need to. That can be quite invaluable. But yeah. Natural pause. Heidi's laughing, but her mic's off, or she's muted herself, so it doesn't come across.
Yeah, I've got noise in the background, so I didn't want everybody to hear it. But if you want to hear my jovial laughter.
We have always have to hear it. Always have to hear it.
Well, at least I don't have a cackle.
What other type of laughter do you have if it's not jovial? Do we?
You know, like evil.
Oh, I see. The witch's cackle.
Yes. Yeah. Or the Mr. Burns. Yes.
Might be time to retire that one.
Yeah, true.
So equipment then. So this is a different spin. So retiring equipment. So the blindingly obvious time when to retire equipment is when it's worn out, right? Or when it's costing you more to fix it than it is generating per year. Slightly different spin on this. So I finally managed to speak to an accountant who I will be employing their services. And they had a conversation with me and they were just sort of throwing some things out there and they were talking about how the natural thing to be would, if you're doing something full-time, would be, let's say, a bandsaw, you would be likely to get a new one every, say, 6 or 7 years. And it's not because that machine's necessarily worn out, but because the depreciation in value offset against your tax allowance has probably it's got to zero. And actually, it might be better for you to either keep that machine, whatever it may be, or sell it secondhand and buy a new one, because then it gives you a tax break. Obviously, rules will be different for different countries. So please, you know, have a chat to your own accountant or work this all out for yourself if you're doing your own bookkeeping and everything else. But that's something to add in that I hadn't ever considered. I've always gone, oh, I'm buying this until it's the end of its life and then I'm going to buy a new one kind of thing. But there is definitely an element to consider of things that will assist you making more money, but not necessarily through sales or services. But say, you know, offsets in your localized tax and all of that kind of thing. Very, very dry subject, which is why I'm employing an accountant and I'm not doing it myself. But that's because I would never have thought of something like that, you know? So that's definitely something to consider. Like, you know, I don't know if it would be the same for you with power hammers, Rasmus. I don't want to give you an excuse to buy more blacksmithing equipment.
I don't need an excuse. I'll just do it. Reckless abandon. I would rather maybe go a slightly different direction of technology moves forward. So even though the tool you currently have is fine, it might cost you more in time and thus money to keep it instead of upgrading to the newest latest version. In my example, in my case, I really want to consider investing in a automatic bandsaw that not only lowers and cuts automatically, but also feeds material automatically.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning I can set it once, this length, toss a 6-meter bit of steel in it and walk away from it, come back later and just pick up all the pieces.
Isn't that called an apprentice?
Yeah, but they are more expensive.
Oh, okay.
Paperwork.
Oh, okay.
And feeding, I think.
Feeding or teething? I didn't quite catch that with the
maybe
accent.
Both, depending on age. I'm not sure. So that's something.
Yeah, technological advancement. Yeah, absolutely.
Like what Heidi did with the laser, like buying a more commercial model, saying like now this has more features. It is also cheap enough to justify buying on the business for the utility I'm getting out of it. Meaning it also then makes it easier to make more money by buying that new tool.
Yeah.
It doesn't and if you have an old one, yeah, then of course you retire that or you keep it as a backup if the new fancy shiny one break, because added complexity it means more points of failure.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about the changes in technology, because as we all know, this is one of the main reasons why I still haven't bought myself a laser CNC. Because every time I start considering one, like another new model's come out, and I'm like, well, I don't want the one that's not the top of the line. Why would I want the inferior one? It's not, you know. But of course, the price doesn't come down. The price just keeps going up, and it gets more features, and so it's just this circle of me just not buying because it's a machine that doesn't make chips or dust from wood.
But then the opposite is how long can you afford not to have that tool?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I'm not currently making anything that would fit in it anyway.
Mm.
I am actually most likely going to be buying a branding iron with my new logo on it for making sure the ass of every lamp has got my signature burnt into it.
Every
lamp's ass is burnt with a branding iron. I think that's the way it should be, really. Let's get some proper fire in there. So that's because the physical size of them wouldn't fit in a domestically available laser anyway, because they're too tall for that, unless you get something like the laser pecker or something like that. So yeah, that's me retiring an attitude, in the sense of I've always been like, well, there's no point buying a branding iron that you have to heat up. Like, yes, they're cheaper, but it's false economy, because in the long run, you're going to have to buy a new one after every 100 stamps or something. But that's literally me retiring the attitude and going, let's be practical about this. This is something that will allow me to do a stopgap on a particular range of product that potentially is going to be a long-running range of product. And it's not a primary thing that, although I will sell them on my website, most of this is going to be wholesale. Most of this is going to be, you know, or at least put in shops and sold through shops. So it's not going to be made in the same way. It's not that it's not the same standard or the same quality, but I can use different techniques that aren't quite what I would be as comfortable with.
Ben and I often have this conversation a lot about, you know, investing in a tool knowing that it's going to be obsolete in a certain period of time. So I'm talking about like when we were early on in his woodworking journey and him wanting to learn the ropes, like, do you buy the Rolls Royce?
Yeah.
Knowing that you're going to eventually want it, but you don't necessarily haven't proven yourself worthy to drive it.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you get the Harbor Freight, you know, equivalent, run that for, you know, 6 months to 2 years until, you know, you've proven out that the journey's worth it and then buy it. So like there's that planned obsolescence with what you're purchasing too. Like, you know that you're going to eventually retire it. And we had a lot of discussions about that. just knowing that, you know, we didn't have the capital to buy the big expensive fancy bandsaw or the big expensive fancy, you know, this, that, or the other thing. I bought a tabletop slab roller when I first started. I didn't have the space for a full-size slab roller, number one. Number two, I didn't really have the number of orders that really made sense to have something that large. I just And the purpose that I was using the slab roller for wasn't, I wasn't hand building. It wasn't my primary tool. I was still throwing. I was using it to make the little badges and cookies. And so it really didn't make sense to buy this big honking piece of equipment that was going to take up the space until I had the space. So there was some planned obsolescence with the smaller slab roller. Then I knew I would eventually upgrade to a larger one once I got into a larger space. But it's just like, it's one of those things that I consistently run into as a business owner is that like balancing act of, okay, well, I need to spend X amount of dollars to pay less in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm going to buy that piece of equipment next year.
Mm-hmm.
So do I buy it on the bankrolls this year to reduce my tax load? Or do I wait until next year to reduce next year's tax load?
Yeah.
It's all of that like paperwork, paperwork bullshit that I think Dan's done a brilliant thing of hiring somebody to do that versus me kind of trying to do it all myself and then going to a numbers person at the end of the year to go like, did I do it right? 9 times out of 10, I do, but I've created more sleepless nights for myself trying to figure out, do I pull the trigger now and retire the old piece of equipment for those benefits? Or do I wait? Because the thing is still, it's still doing pretty good. I'm not, you know, whatever X, Y, Z reason. Last year, I invested in a new pottery wheel and it was like multi-parts reasoning. Number one, I was having back issues from sitting and throwing. And one of the things that some of my other potter friends have done is they upgraded to a standing wheel. Either they took their wheel and they put it on cinder blocks or they built some kind of apparatus. I decided that the wheel that I had was great for a hobbyist.
Yeah.
Right. It had enough torque. It was a workhorse of a pottery wheel for a hobbyist, but I needed something that was easier to clean. Mm-hmm. I needed something that I could move around without having to like move a bunch of cinder blocks and, you know, lift this thing and put it down or whatever. So I wanted something that had commercially made legs that could lower, because I'm short, so I'm only 5'2", so I don't necessarily need a wheel that'll fit a 6-foot person standing. I needed something that would work for me as a short person. And then there were like a bunch of other considerations too that made me pull the trigger last year, like the new studio. And, you know, I was already putting a lot of capital into the business at that point. But I also realized like I didn't have to sell the old wheel.
Mm. Yeah.
And you know what? That wheel is now a trimming wheel. So I just have my trimming bat already on it. Nice. So when I'm ready to use it, I just move over to that. And I don't know if there's like things in your workflow that maybe you retired it for one task, but it inherited a whole new life because it was now functionally something that you could just keep, you know, this blade on it. And then never have to swap it out again. Like, is there anything like that in your shop that retired from one function, but migrated to a new function and not just like, you know, coat rack?
Yeah.
Situation.
So
anvils. I have anvils.
Yeah. Anvil coat racks. Yeah.
Yes.
So on my, not in my specific shop, but there was, well, other than everything becoming a shelf when it's not in use. When I worked for Crimson Guitars and we were making guitars there, they had a slide out cross cut saw, and it was this tiny little thing, but there was a blade on it that had been reground specifically from a normal circular saw blade so that it was the right when it cut a slot, it was the right width to put fret wire in.
Mm.
So whereas commercial blades with the way their teeth are out and everything, it's like a 4 mil width of cut or something like that, depending on the blade you buy. But that's like, it might be 2.5 to 4. I can't remember what it is, but it needed to be about half that thickness in order to fit fret wire in. And because of the amount of fretboards you're doing, you know, if you want to make sure they're absolutely perfectly square rather than hand cutting them and this, that, and everything else, from a production perspective, this saw was literally set aside with this blade, and it had a little jig system set up so that you could get your fretboard in place and literally just sort of run across at the right marking spacing. And it was so much faster and more accurate, provided it hadn't been abused by one of the other of the 15 members of staff who were working there. So that was definitely something where I know that the owner, that had been like his crosscut saw. And then when he'd got further along, he'd got a new saw and then thought, actually, rather than throwing this away, which still works, if I just get this blade reground, this is now dedicated to a job. So that was definitely something where it was retired from one generic function to now it's become a specific tool. But no, in my own workshop, I don't have anything. I don't think that's more like that. I'll have a bit more of a think on it while Raz answers the question.
I were not joking. I have anvils that used to be my main forging anvils, and then I retired it because I bought a new one that was bigger, better, faster, stronger, or something. And now
there's
I have
in there somewhere.
Yeah,
better, faster, stronger.
One with peace in it, I think. And I basically have like my old forging anvil, my old made one, now is the anvil I use for making roses because it's the perfect height for that process.
Did you call it your old maid?
Main.
Oh.
I thought you said old maid as well. I just thought, this is an interesting blacksmithing term.
Oh,
I was going to go over to the old maid and bash some metal out on her a bit.
The old maid.
I mean, it is a bit broken, but anyway.
Milks well.
Still makes me lots of money.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah, I have anvils that I'm not using every single day, but it has the perfect hardy hole. It has the tool that fits really nice, and that is the correct height to do a certain process on. So that's sort of the one I use only for this step. And because I am me, when I do some forging operations, I want to have multiple anvils set up at the same time with different tools on them, so that I, in one single heat, can move from one to the other and keep the process going, keep the heat going, and be as efficient as possible. Instead of doing one process on one heat, doing that on 20 pieces, then retooling the anvil, so to speak, doing another heat, and so on and so forth, and sort of compressing that timeline a bit.
So what we're all basically doing is going on record saying, this is why you should never throw any tools or equipment or you know, materials away, because they will come in handy for one process for that occasional time you need to do it. So for any of you who struggle with this conversation with any partners you may have, then we recommend that they listen to this podcast as well. But they'll have to start season one, episode one, and make sure they listen through all of the episodes, because of course that will also be showing support for us too.
Yes, like,
and then
comment,
this subliminal messaging will just get in there so that eventually they will be coming to you saying, no, don't throw that away. That may be useful for you in the future.
And we also now have a special Patreon tier, so we can call your spouse out by name.
Oh, well, that'd be fun. Yes. I think this is definitely the point to wrap this episode up, because we know Heidi's got to crack on with some adulting, which is, you know, always sad to have to wake up to that realization. But it's been great to chat to you guys as always, and we hope that everyone is enjoying all of the many, many things that we talk about. Can you tell I'm stalling for time while I'm trying to look something up on my phone? Give me a moment.
Really well.
The reason why is because we've received our first email.
And the
guys don't know this yet. So we've received our first email, and it is from the lovely Woodseats, Richard Martin.
Oh, hi, Richard.
Who he makes things out of pallet wood and other stuff, but he's been listening to the show a lot, and so he's written and he said, definitely not a wood turner or a potter or a blacksmith. I'm an occasional seller at craft fairs, general maker of stuff from reclaimed materials. Anyway, I'm really loving the show. It gives great perspectives and has even kicked my ass to getting back to selling at craft fairs.
Okay.
Might even do more than just two this year. Keep at it. Lots of thanks, Rich. So that's amazing. Thank you very much, Rich, for writing in. And if you want to get your name read out on the podcast, then please. Feel free to email us or pop us a message on there. However, if you happen to be Irish and called Alan, then any jokes sent to us will not get read out. You've already got a platform for that. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. I hope you found it interesting. Next week, I believe, or next episode, I should say, I had written down what we were potentially going to talk about, but we may change it to snobbery because we were obviously all very passionately invested in that. And as I said, that may become a three-part episode. We'll wait and see.
We might end up alienating the 1,001 listeners that you posted about today. So
maybe we'll
curb our enthusiasm on that one.
Absolutely. We'll have to save it for the 2001 launch episode or something like that. Okay, so you can get hold of us, as always, at settinguphop.com, shop spelled S-H-O-P-P-E. You can email us at info@settinguphop.com, or our Instagram is setting_shop, S-H-O-P-P-E, settinguphop with the underscores between the words. If you like to get hold of us individually, you can find me on social media at tarants.co.uk. That is T-A-R-R-A-N-T. And you can find Heidi at Whitehall Pottery. And you can find Rasmus at anvilpimp.com. at Rasmus Lowen.
I'm very surprised you didn't stack that into being Anvil Pimp on OnlyFans.
No, not at all. Not at all. I do think you might have quickly make this account before someone steals it and puts your face all over it.
Oh, where's the t-shirt?
Exactly. Right, guys. Thank you very much. Lovely to chat to you all. And please tune in next week for another exciting episode. Bye.
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 Are we sure it was Richard, though? Because that email sounded polite.
No, it genuinely was. That was him, yeah.
We're still recording.
I know. I wanted that in there at the end.